This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present To Sir Philip with Love by Julia Quinn, narrated by Rosalind Landor.
I know you say I shall some day like boys, but I say never, never, with 3 exclamation points.
From Eloise Bridgerton to her mother, shoved under Violet Bridgerton's door during Eloise's 8th year.
I never dreamed that a season could be so exciting. The men are so handsome and charming. I know I shall fall in love straight away. How could I not?
From Eloise Bridgerton to her brother Colin, upon the occasion of her London debut.
I am quite certain I shall never marry. If there was someone out there for me, don't you think I should have found him by now?
From Eloise Bridgerton to her dear friend Penelope Featherington, during her 6th season as a debutante.
This is my last chance. I am grabbing destiny with both my hands and throwing caution to the wind. Sir Philip, please, please be all that I have imagined you to be. Because if you are the man your letters portray you to be, I think I could love you. And if you felt the same.
From Eloise Bridgerton, jotted on a scrap of paper, on her way to meet Sir Philip Crane for the very first time. Prologue. February 1823. Gloucestershire, England. It was ironic, really, that it had happened on such a sunny day. The first sunny day in, what had it been? 6 straight weeks of grey skies, accompanied by the occasional sprinkling of light snow or rain. Even Philip, who'd thought himself impervious to the vagaries of the weather, had felt his spirits lighten, his smile widen. He'd gone outside. He'd had to. No one could remain indoors during such a splendid display of sunshine, especially in the middle of such a grey winter. Even now, more than a month after it had happened, he couldn't quite believe that the sun had had the temerity to tease him so. And how was it that he'd been so blind that he'd not expected it? He'd lived with Marina since the day of their marriage. 8 long years to know the woman. He should have expected it. And in truth, well, in truth, he had expected it. He just hadn't wanted to admit to the expectation. Perhaps he was just trying to delude himself, protect himself even, to hide from the obvious, hoping that if he didn't think about it, it would never happen. But it did. And on a sunny day to boot. God certainly had a sick sense of humour. He looked down at his glass of whisky, which was, quite inexplicably, empty. He must have drunk the damned thing, and yet he had no memory of doing so. He didn't feel woozy, at least not as woozy as he should have been, or even as woozy as he wanted to be. He stared out the window at the sun, which was slipping low on the horizon. It had been another sunny day today. That probably explained his exceptional melancholy. At least he hoped it did. He wanted an explanation, needed one, for this awful tiredness that seemed to be taking over. Melancholy terrified him. More than anything. More than fire. More than war. More than hell itself. The thought of sinking into sadness. Of being like her. Marina had been melancholy. Marina had spent her entire life, or at least the entire life he'd known, melancholy. He couldn't remember the sound of her laughter, and in truth, he wasn't sure that he'd ever known it. It had been a sunny day, and he squeezed his eyes shut, not certain whether the motion was meant to urge the memory or dispel it. It had been a sunny day, and...
Never thought you'd feel the likes of that on your skin again, eh, Sir Philip?
Philip Crane turned his face to the sun, closing his eyes as he let the warmth spread over his skin.
It's perfect, he murmured. Or it would be, if it weren't so bloody cold.
Miles Carter, his secretary, chuckled.
It's not as cold as that. The lake hasn't frozen this year.
just a few patchy spots. Reluctantly, Philip turned away from the sun and opened his eyes.
It isn't spring, though.
If you were wishing for spring, sir, perhaps you should have consulted a calendar. Philip regarded him with a sideways glance.
Do I pay you for such impertinence?
Indeed, and rather handsomely, too. Philip smiled to himself as both men paused to enjoy the sun for a few moments longer.
I thought you didn't mind the grey, Miles said conversationally, once they'd resumed their trek to Philip's greenhouse.
I don't, Philip said, striding along with the confidence of a natural athlete. But just because I don't mind an overcast sky doesn't mean I don't prefer the sun.
He paused, thought for a moment.
Be sure to tell Nurse Milsby to take the children outside today. They'll need warm coats, of course, and hats and mittens and the like, but they ought to get a little sun on their faces. They've been cooped up far too long.
As have we all, Miles murmured.
Philip chuckled.
Indeed.
He glanced over his shoulder at his greenhouse. He probably ought to take care of his correspondence now, but he had some seeds he needed to sort through. And truly, there was no reason he couldn't conduct his business with Miles in an hour or so.
Go on, he said to Miles. Find Nurse Milsby. You and I can deal later.
You know you hate the greenhouse anyway.
Not this time of year, Miles said. The heat is rather welcome.
Philip arched a brow as he inclined his head toward Romney Hall.
Are you calling my ancestral home draughty?
All ancestral homes are draughty.
True enough, Philip said with a grin.
He rather liked Miles. He'd hired him 6 months earlier to help with the mountains of paperwork and details that seemed to accumulate from the running of his small property. Miles was quite good. Young, but good. And his dry sense of humour was certainly welcome in a house where laughter was never in abundance. The servants would never dare joke with Philip, and Marina, well, it went without saying that Marina did not laugh or tease. The children sometimes made Philip laugh, but that was a different sort of humour, and besides, most of the time he did not know what to say to them. He tried, but then he felt too awkward, too big, too strong, if such a thing were possible, and then he just found himself shooing them off, telling them to go back to their nurse. It was easier that way.
Go on, then,
Philip said, sending Miles off on a task he probably should have done himself. He hadn't seen his children yet today, and he supposed he ought to, but he didn't want to spoil the day by saying something stern, which he inevitably seemed to do. He'd find them while they were off on their nature walk with Nurse Milsby. That would be a good idea. Then he could point out some sort of plant and tell them about it, and everything would remain perfectly simple and benign. Philip entered his greenhouse and shut the door behind him, taking a welcome breath of the moist air. He'd studied botany at Cambridge, taken a first, even, and, in truth, he'd probably have taken up an academic life if his older brother had not died at Waterloo, thrusting the second-born Philip into the role of landowner and country gentleman. He supposed it could have been worse. He could have been landowner and city gentleman after all. At least here he was able to pursue his botanical pursuits in relative serenity. He bent over his workbench, examining his latest project, a strain of peas that he was trying to breed to grow fatter and plumper in the pod. No luck yet, though. This latest batch was not just shrivelled, but had even turned yellow, which had not been the expected result at all. Philip frowned, then allowed himself a small smile, as he moved to the back of the greenhouse to gather his supplies. He never minded too terribly when his experiments did not produce the expected outcome. In his opinion, necessity had never been the mother of invention. Accidents. It was all about accidents. No scientist would admit to it, of course, but most great invention occurred while one was attempting to solve some other problem entirely. He chuckled as he swept the shriveled peas aside. At this rate, he'd cure gout by the end of the year. Back to work. Back to work. He bent over his seed collection, smoothing them out so that he could examine them all. He needed just the right one for... He looked up and out the freshly washed glass. A movement across the field caught his eye. A flash of red. Red. Philip smiled to himself as he shook his head. It must be Marina. Red was her favourite colour. Something that he'd always found odd. Anyone who spent any time with her would have surely thought she'd prefer something darker, more sombre. He watched as she disappeared into the wooded copse, then got back to work. It was rare for Marina to venture outside. These days she didn't often leave the confines of her bedchamber. Philip was happy to see her out in the sun. Maybe it would restore her spirits. Not completely, of course. Philip didn't think even the sun had the ability to do that. But maybe a bright, warm day would be enough to draw her out for a few hours, bring a small smile to her face. Heaven knew the children could use that. They visited their mother in her room almost every evening, but it wasn't enough, and Philip knew that this lack was not made up for by him. He sighed, a wave of guilt washing over him. He was not the sort of father they needed. He knew that. He tried to tell himself that he was doing his best, that he was succeeding in what was his only goal when it came to parenthood, that he not behave in the manner of his own father. But still, he knew it wasn't enough. With resolute motions, he pushed himself away from his workbench. The seeds could wait. His children could probably wait too, but that didn't mean they should. And he ought to take them on their nature walk, not Nurse Milsby, who didn't know a deciduous tree from a coniferous, and would most likely tell them that a rose was a daisy and... He glanced out the window again, reminding himself that it was February. Nurse Milsby wasn't likely to locate any sort of flower in this weather. But still, it didn't excuse the fact that he ought to take the children on their nature walk. It was the one sort of children's activity at which he truly excelled, and he ought not shirk the responsibility. He strode out of the greenhouse, but then stopped, not even a third of the way back to Romney Hall. If he was going to fetch the children, he ought to take them out to see their mother. They craved her company, even when she did nothing more than pat them on the head. Yes, they should find Marina. That would be even more beneficial than a nature walk. But he knew from experience that he ought not make assumptions about Marina's state of mind. Just because she'd ventured outside did not mean that she was feeling well. And he hated when the children saw her in one of her moods. Philip turned around and headed out toward the copse, where he'd seen Marina disappear just a few moments earlier. He walked with nearly twice the speed of Marina. It wouldn't take very long to catch up to her and ascertain her mood. He could be back at the nursery before the children set out with Nurse Milsby. He walked through the woods, easily following Marina's path. The ground was moist, and Marina must have been wearing heavy boots, because her prints had sunk into the earth with clear definition. They led down the slight incline and out of the woods, then onto a grassy patch. "Damn," Philip muttered, the word barely audible as the wind picked up around him. It was impossible to see her footprints on the grass. He used his hand to shade his eyes from the sun and scanned the horizon, looking for a telltale scrap of red. Not near the abandoned cottage, nor at Philip's field of experimental grains, nor at the large boulder that Philip had spent so many hours clambering upon when he was a child. He turned north, his eyes narrowing when he finally saw her. She was heading toward the lake. The lake. Philip's lips parted as he stared down at her form, moving slowly toward the water's edge. He wasn't quite frozen. It was more that he was suspended, as his mind took in the strange sight. Marina didn't swim. He didn't even know if she could. He supposed she was aware that there was a lake on the grounds, but in truth he'd never known her to go there, not in the 8 years they'd been married. He started walking toward her, his feet somehow recognizing what his mind refused to accept. As she stepped into the shallows, he picked up speed, still too far to do anything but call out her name. But if she heard him, she made no indication, just continued her slow and steady progress into the depths.
"Marina!"
he screamed, now breaking into a run. He was still a good minute away, even moving at top speed.
"Marina!"
She reached the point where the bottom dropped off, and then she dropped off too, disappearing under the gunmetal grey of the surface, her red cloak floating along the top for a few seconds before being sucked under after her. He yelled her name again, even though she couldn't possibly hear. He skidded and stumbled down the hill leading to the lake, then had just enough presence of mind to yank off his coat and boots before diving into the freezing cold water. She'd been under barely a minute. His mind recognized that that was probably not enough time to drown, but every second it took him to find her was 1 second toward her death. He'd swum in the lake countless times, knew exactly where the bottom dropped off, and he reached that critical point with swift, even strokes, barely noticing the drag of the water against his heavy clothes. He could find her. He had to find her, before it was too late. He dove down, his eyes scanning the murky water. Marina must have kicked up some of the sand from the bottom, and he had surely done the same, because the fine silt was swirling around him, the puffy, opaque clouds making it difficult to see. But in the end, Marina was saved by her one colourful quirk, and Philip pumped through the water, down to the bottom, where he saw the red of her cloak floating through the water like a languorous kite. She did not fight him as he pulled her to the surface. Indeed, she had already lost consciousness, and was nothing more than a dead weight in his arms. They broke out into the air, and he took great big gasps to fill his burning lungs. For a moment he could do nothing but breathe, his body recognizing that it had to save itself before he could save anyone else. Then he pulled her along to the shore, careful to keep her face above water, even though she didn't seem to be breathing. Finally, they reached the water's edge, and he dragged her upon the narrow strip of dirt and pebbles that separated the water from the grass. With frantic movements he felt in front of her face for air, but there was none emerging from her lips. He didn't know what to do, hadn't thought he'd ever have to save someone from drowning, so he just did what seemed most sensible, and heaved her over his lap, face down, whacking her on the back. Nothing happened at first, but after the fourth violent thrust, she coughed, and a stream of murky water erupted from her mouth. He turned her over quickly.
"Marina!"
he asked urgently, lightly slapping her face.
"Marina!"
She coughed again, her body racked by spasmodic tremors. Then she began to suck in air, her lungs forcing her to live, even when her soul desired something else.
"Marina!"
Philip said, his voice shaking with relief.
"Thank God!"
He didn't love her, had never really loved her, but she was his wife, and she was the mother of his children, and she was, deep down, beneath her unshakable cloak of sorrow and despair, a good and fine person. He may not have loved her, but he did not want her death. She blinked, her eyes unfocused, and then, finally, she seemed to realize where she was, who he was, and she whispered,
"No."
"I've got to get you back to the house,"
he said gruffly, startled by how angry he was over that single word. No. How dare she refuse his rescue? Would she give up on life just because she was sad? Did her melancholy amount to more than their 2 children? In the balance of life, did a bad mood weigh more than their need for a mother?
"I'm taking you home,"
he bit out, heaving her none too gently into his arms. She was breathing now, and clearly in possession of her faculties, misguided though they may be. There was no need to treat her like a delicate flower.
"No," she sobbed quietly. "Please don't. I don't want. I don't."
"You're going home," he stated, trudging up the hill, oblivious to the chill wind turning his sodden clothes to ice, oblivious even to the rocky soil pressing into his unshod feet.
"I can't," she whispered, with what seemed like her last ounce of energy.
And as Philip carried his burden home, all he could think was how apt those words were. "I can't." In a way, it seemed to sum up her entire life. By nightfall, it became apparent that fever might succeed where the lake had failed. Philip had carried Marina home as quickly as he was able, and, with the aid of Mrs. Hurley, his housekeeper, had stripped her of her icy garments and tried to warm her beneath the goose-down quilt that had been the centrepiece of her trousseau 8 years earlier.
"What happened?"
Mrs. Hurley had gasped when he staggered through the kitchen door. He hadn't wanted to use the main entrance, where he might be seen by his children. And besides, the kitchen door was closer by a good 20 yards.
"She fell in the lake," he said gruffly.
Mrs. Hurley gave him a look that was somehow dubious and sympathetic all at the same time, and he knew that she knew the truth. She had worked for the Cranes since their marriage. She knew Marina's moods. She had shooed him out of the room once they had Marina in bed, insisting that he change his own clothing before he caught his death as well. He had returned, though, to Marina's side. That was his place as her husband, he thought guiltily, a place he had avoided in recent years. It was depressing to be with Marina. It was hard. But now wasn't the time to shirk his duties, and so he sat at her bedside throughout the day and into the night. He mopped her brow when she began to perspire, tried to pour lukewarm broth down her throat when she was calm. He told her to fight, even though he knew his words fell on deaf ears. 3 days later, she was dead. It was what she'd wanted, but that was little comfort as Philip faced his children. Twins, just turned 7 years old, and tried to explain that their mother was gone. He sat in their nursery, his large frame too big for any of their tot-sized chairs. But he sat anyway, twisted like a pretzel, and forced himself to meet their gazes as he wrenched out the words. They said little, which was unlike them, but they didn't look surprised, which Philip found disturbing.
I'm sorry, he choked out, once he reached the end of his speech. He loved them so much, and he failed them in so many ways. He barely knew how to be a father to them. How in hell was he meant to take on the role of mother as well?
It's not your fault,
Oliver said, his brown eyes capturing his father's with an intensity that was unsettling.
She fell in the lake, didn't she? You didn't push her.
Philip only nodded, unsure of how to respond.
Is she happy now?
Amanda asked softly.
I think so, Philip said. She gets to watch you all the time now from heaven, so she must be happy.
The twins seemed to consider that for quite some time.
I hope she's happy,
Oliver finally said, his voice more resolute than his expression.
Maybe she won't cry any more.
Philip felt his breath catch in his throat. He hadn't realized that they had heard Marina's sobs. She only seemed to sink so low late at night. Their room was directly above hers, but he'd always assumed they'd already fallen asleep when their mother started to cry. Amanda nodded her agreement, her little blonde head bobbing up and down.
If she's happy now, she said, then I'm glad she's gone.
She's not gone,
Oliver cut in.
She's dead.
No, she's gone,
Amanda persisted.
It's the same thing, Philip said flatly.
wishing he had something to tell them other than the truth. "But I think she's happy now." And in a way, that was the truth too. It was what Marina had wanted, after all. Maybe it was all she had wanted all along. Amanda and Oliver were quiet for a long while, both keeping their eyes on the floor as their legs swung from their perch on Oliver's bed. They looked so small, sitting there on a bed that was clearly too high for them. Philip frowned. How was it that he'd never noticed this before? Shouldn't they be on lower beds? What if they fell off in the night? Or maybe they were too big for all that. Maybe they didn't fall out of bed any longer. Maybe they never had. Maybe he truly was an abominable father. Maybe he should know these things. Maybe. He closed his eyes and sighed. Maybe he should stop thinking quite so much and simply try his best and be happy with that.
"Are you going to go away?"
Amanda asked, raising her head. He looked into her eyes, so blue, so like her mother's.
"No,"
he whispered fiercely, kneeling before her and taking her tiny hands in his own. They looked so small in his grasp, so fragile.
"No," he repeated. "I'm not going away. I'm not ever going away."
Philip looked down at his whiskey glass. It was empty again. Funny how a whiskey glass could go empty, even after one filled it four times. He hated remembering. He wasn't sure what was the worst. Was it the dive underwater, or the moment Mrs. Hurley had turned to him and said, "She's gone"? Or was it his children? The sorrow on their faces, the fear in their eyes. He lifted the glass to his lips, letting the final drops slide into his mouth. The worst part was definitely his children. He'd told them he wouldn't ever leave them. And he hadn't. He wouldn't. But his simple presence wasn't enough. They needed more. They needed someone who knew how to be a parent, who knew how to speak to them and understand them, and get them to mind and behave. And since he couldn't very well get them another father, he supposed he ought to think about finding them a mother. It was too soon, of course. He couldn't marry anyone until his prescribed period of mourning was completed, but that didn't mean he couldn't look. He sighed, slumping in his seat. He needed a wife. Almost any wife would do. He didn't care what she looked like. He didn't care if she had money. He didn't care if she could do sums in her head, or speak French, or even ride a horse. She just had to be happy. Was that so much to want in a wife? A smile, at least once a day. Maybe even the sound of her laughter. And she had to love his children, or at least pretend so well that they never knew the difference. It wasn't so much to ask for, was it?
"Sir Philip."
Philip looked up, cursing himself for having left his study door slightly ajar. Miles Carter, his secretary, was poking his head in.
"What is it?"
"A letter, sir," Miles said, walking forward to hand him an envelope.
"From London."
Philip looked down at the envelope in his hand, his brows rising at the obviously feminine slant to the handwriting. He dismissed Miles with a nod, then picked up his letter opener and slid it under the wax. A single sheet of paper slipped out. Philip rubbed it between his fingers. High quality. Expensive. Heavy, too. A clear sign that the sender need not economise to reduce franking costs. Then he turned it over and read,
"Number 5, Bruton Street, London. Sir Philip Crane, I am writing to express my condolences on the loss of your wife, my dear cousin Marina. Although it has been many years since I last saw Marina, I remember her fondly and was deeply saddened to hear of her passing. Please do not hesitate to write if there is anything I can do to ease your pain at this difficult time. Yours, Miss Eloise Bridgerton."
Philip rubbed his eyes. Bridgerton. Bridgerton. Did Marina have Bridgerton cousins? She must have done, if one of them was sending him a letter. He sighed, then surprised himself by reaching for his own stationery and quill. He'd received precious few condolence notes since Marina had died. It seemed most of her friends and family had forgotten her since her marriage. He supposed he shouldn't be upset, or even surprised. She'd rarely left her bedchamber. It was easy to forget about someone one never saw. Miss Bridgerton deserved a reply. It was common courtesy, or even if it wasn't, and Philip was quite certain he didn't know the full etiquette of one's wife dying. It still somehow seemed like the right thing to do. And so, with a weary breath, he put his quill to paper. Chapter 1. May, 1824. Somewhere on the road from London to Gloucestershire, the middle of the night.
Dear Miss Bridgerton, thank you for your kind note at the loss of my wife. It was thoughtful of you to take the time to write to a gentleman you have never met. I offer you this pressed flower as thanks. It is naught but the simple red campion, Silene dioica, but it brightens the fields here in Gloucestershire, and indeed seems to have arrived early this year. It was Marina's favourite wildflower. Sincerely, Sir Philip Crane.
Eloise Bridgerton smoothed the well-read sheet of paper across her lap. There was little light by which to see the words, even with the full moon shining through the windows of the coach, but that didn't really matter. She had the entire letter memorised, and the delicate pressed flower, which was actually more pink than red, was safely protected between the pages of a book she'd nipped from her brother's library. She hadn't been too terribly surprised when she'd received a reply from Sir Philip. Good manners dictated as much, although even Eloise's mother, surely the supreme arbiter of good behaviour, said that Eloise took her correspondence a bit too seriously. It was common, of course, for ladies of Eloise's station to spend several hours each week writing letters, but Eloise had long since fallen into the habit of taking that amount of time each day. She enjoyed writing notes, especially to people she hadn't seen in years. She'd always liked to imagine their surprise when they opened her envelope, and so she pulled out her pen and paper for most any occasion. Births, deaths, any sort of achievement that deserved congratulations or condolences. She wasn't sure why she kept sending her missives, just that she spent so much time writing letters to whichever of her siblings were not in residence in London at the time, and it seemed easy enough to pen a short note to some far-off relative while she was seated at her escritoire. And although everyone penned a short note in reply, she was a Bridgerton, of course, and no one wanted to offend a Bridgerton. Never had anyone enclosed a gift, even something so humble as a pressed flower. Eloise closed her eyes, picturing the delicate pink petals. It was hard to imagine a man handling such a fragile bloom. Her four brothers were all big, strong men, with broad shoulders and large hands that would surely mangle the poor thing in a heartbeat. She had been intrigued by Sir Philip's reply, especially his use of the Latin, and she had immediately penned her own response.
"Dear Sir Philip, thank you so very much for the charming pressed flower. It was such a lovely surprise when it floated out of the envelope, and such a precious memento of dear Marina as well. I could not help but notice your facility with the flower's scientific name. Are you a botanist? Yours, Miss Eloise Bridgerton."
It was sneaky of her to end her letter with a question. Now the poor man would be forced to respond again. He did not disappoint her. It had taken only 10 days for Eloise to receive his reply.
"Dear Miss Bridgerton, indeed I am a botanist, trained at Cambridge. Although I am not currently connected with any university or scientific board, I conduct experiments here at Romney Hall, in my own greenhouse. Are you of a scientific bent as well? Yours, Sir Philip Crane."
Something about the correspondence was thrilling. Perhaps it was simply the excitement of finding someone not related to her who actually seemed eager to conduct a written dialogue. Whatever it was, Eloise wrote back immediately.
Dear Sir Philip, heavens no, I have not the scientific mind, I'm afraid, although I do have a fair head for sums. My interests lie more in the humanities. You may have noticed that I enjoy penning letters. Yours in friendship, Eloise Bridgerton.
Eloise hadn't been certain about signing with such an informal salutation, but she decided to err on the side of daring. Sir Philip was obviously enjoying the correspondence as much as she. Surely he wouldn't have finished his missive with a question otherwise. Her answer came a fortnight later.
My dear Miss Bridgerton, ah, but it is a sort of friendship, isn't it? I confess to a certain measure of isolation here in the country, and if one cannot have a smiling face across one's breakfast table, then one might at least have an amiable letter. Don't you agree? I have enclosed another flower for you. This one is Geranium pratense, more commonly known as the Meadow Cranesbill. With great regard, Philip Crane.
Eloise remembered that day well. She had sat in her chair, the one by the window in her bedchamber, and stared at the carefully pressed purple flower for what seemed like an eternity. Was he attempting to court her? Through the post? And then one day she received a note that was quite different from the rest.
My dear Miss Bridgerton, we have been corresponding now for quite some time, and although we have never formally met, I feel as if I know you. I hope you feel the same. Forgive me if I am too bold, but I am writing to invite you to visit me here at Romney Hall. It is my hope that after a suitable period of time, we might decide that we will suit, and you will consent to be my wife. You will, of course, be properly chaperoned. If you accept my invitation, I will make immediate plans to bring my widowed aunt to Romney Hall. I do hope you will consider my proposal. Yours, as always, Philip Crane.
Eloise had immediately tucked the letter away in a drawer, unable to even fathom his request. He wanted to marry someone he didn't even know. No, to be fair, that wasn't entirely true. They did know one another. They'd said more in the course of a year's correspondence than many husbands and wives did during the entire course of a marriage. But still, they'd never met. Eloise thought about all of the marriage proposals she'd refused over the years. How many had there been? At least six. Now she couldn't even remember why she'd refused some of them. No reason, really, except that they weren't perfect. Was that so much to expect? She shook her head, aware that she sounded silly and spoiled. No, she didn't need someone perfect. She just needed someone perfect for her. She knew what the society matron said about her. She was too demanding, worse than foolish. She'd end up a spinster. No, they didn't say that any more. They said she already was a spinster, which was true. One didn't reach the age of 28 without hearing that whispered behind one's back, or thrown in one's face. But the funny truth was, Eloise didn't mind her situation, or at least she hadn't, not until recently. It had never occurred to her that she'd always be a spinster, and besides, she enjoyed her life quite well. She had the most marvellous family one could imagine. Seven brothers and sisters in all, named alphabetically, which put her right in the middle at E, with four older and three younger. Her mother was a delight, and she'd even stopped nagging Eloise about getting married. Eloise still held a prominent place in society. The Bridgertons were universally adored and respected, and occasionally feared, and Eloise's sunny and irrepressible personality was such that everyone sought out her company, spinsterish age or no. But lately, she sighed, suddenly feeling quite a bit older than her 28 years. Lately, she hadn't been feeling so sunny. Lately, she'd been starting to think that maybe those crotchety old matrons were right, and she wasn't going to find herself a husband. Maybe she had been too picky, too determined to follow the example of her older brothers and sister, all of whom had found a deep and passionate love with their spouses, even if it hadn't necessarily been there at the outset. Maybe a marriage based on mutual respect and companionship was better than none at all. But it was difficult to talk about these feelings with anyone. Her mother had spent so many years urging her to find a husband. As much as Eloise adored her, it would be difficult to eat crow and say that she should have listened. Her brothers would have been no help whatsoever. Anthony, the eldest, would probably have taken it upon himself to personally select a suitable mate and then browbeat the poor man into submission. Benedict was too much of a dreamer, and besides, he almost never came down to London any more, preferring the quiet of the country. As for Colin, well, that was another story entirely, quite worthy of its own paragraph. She supposed she should have talked to Daphne, but every time she went to see her, her elder sister was so bloody happy, so blissfully in love with her husband and her life as mother to her brood of four. How could someone like that possibly offer useful advice to one in Eloise's position? And Francesca seemed half a world away, off in Scotland. Besides, Eloise didn't think it fair to bother her with her silly woes. Francesca had been widowed at the age of 23, for heaven's sake. Eloise's fears and worries seemed terribly inconsequential by comparison. And maybe all this was why her correspondence with Sir Philip had become such a guilty pleasure. The Bridgertons were a large family, loud and boisterous. It was nearly impossible to keep anything a secret, especially from her sisters, the youngest of whom, Hyacinth, could probably have won the war against Napoleon in half the time if His Majesty had only thought to draft her into the espionage service. Sir Philip was, in his own strange way, hers, the one thing she'd never had to share with anyone. His letters were bundled and tied with a purple ribbon, hidden at the bottom of her middle desk drawer, tucked underneath the piles of stationery she used for her many letters. He was her secret, hers, and because she'd never actually met him, she'd been able to create him in her mind, using his letters as the bones, and then fleshing him out as she saw fit. If ever there was a perfect man, surely it had to be the Sir Philip Crane of her imagination. And now he wanted to meet. Meet? Was he mad? And ruin what had to be the perfect courtship? But then the impossible had occurred. Penelope Featherington, Eloise's closest friend for nearly a dozen years, had married. And what's more, she'd married Colin, Eloise's brother. If the moon had suddenly dropped from the sky and landed in her back garden, Eloise could not have been more surprised. Eloise was happy for Penelope. Truly she was. And she was happy for Colin, too. They were quite possibly her two most favourite people in the entire world, and she was thrilled that they had found happiness. No one deserved it more. But that didn't mean that their marriage hadn't left a hollow spot in her life. She supposed that when she'd been considering her life as a spinster and trying to convince herself that it was what she really wanted, Penelope had always been there in the image, spinster right beside her. It was acceptable, almost daring even, to be 28 and unmarried, as long as Penelope was 28 and unmarried as well. It wasn't that she hadn't wanted Penelope to find a husband. It was just that it had never seemed even the least bit likely. Eloise knew that Penelope was wonderful and kind and smart and witty, but the gentleman of the ton had never seemed to notice. In all her years in society, 11 in all, Penelope had not received one proposal of marriage, nor even a whiff of interest. In a way, Eloise had counted on her to remain where she was, what she was. First and foremost, Eloise's friend, her companion in spinsterhood. And the worst part, the part that left Eloise racked with guilt, was that she'd never given a thought to how Penelope might feel if she married first, which, in truth, she'd always supposed she would do. But now Penelope had Colin, and Eloise could see that the match was a splendid thing. And she was alone, alone in the middle of crowded London, in the middle of a large and loving family. It was hard to imagine a lonelier spot. Suddenly, Sir Philip's bold proposal, tucked away at the very bottom of her bundle, at the bottom of the middle drawer, locked away in a newly purchased safe box, just so that Eloise wouldn't be tempted to look at it 6 times a day, well, it seemed a bit more intriguing. More intriguing by the day, frankly, as she grew more and more restless, more dissatisfied with the lot in life that she had to admit she'd chosen. And so, one day, after she'd gone to visit Penelope, only to be informed by the butler that Mr. and Mrs. Bridgerton were not able to receive visitors, uttered in such a way that even Eloise knew what it meant, she made a decision. It was time to take her life into her own hands, time to control her destiny, rather than attending ball after ball, in the vain hope that the perfect man would suddenly materialise before her, never mind that there was never anybody new in London, and after a full decade out in society, she'd already met everyone of the appropriate age and gender to marry. She told herself that this did not mean she had to marry Sir Philip. She was merely investigating what seemed like it might be an excellent possibility. If they did not suit, they would not have to marry. She'd made no promises to him after all. But if there was one thing about Eloise, it was that when she made a decision, she acted upon it quickly. No, she reflected, with a rather impressive, in her opinion at least, display of self-honesty, there were 2 things about her that coloured her every action. She liked to act quickly, and she was tenacious. Penelope had once described her as akin to a dog with a bone, and Penelope had not been joking. Once Eloise got her claws into an idea, not even the full force of the Bridgerton family could sway her from her intended goal, and the Bridgertons constituted a mighty force indeed. It was probably just dumb luck that her goals and those of her family had never crossed purposes before, at least not over anything important. Eloise knew that they would never countenance her going off blindly to meet a man she'd never met. Antony would have probably demanded that Sir Philip come to London to meet the entire family en masse, and Eloise couldn't imagine a single scenario more likely to scare off a prospective suitor. The men who'd previously sought her favour were at least familiar with the London scene and knew what they were getting into. Poor Sir Philip, who had, by his own admission in his letters, not set foot in London since his school days and never participated in the social season, would be ambushed. So the only option was for her to travel to Gloucestershire. And, as she came to realise after pondering the problem for a few days, she had to do it in secret. If her family knew of her plans, they might very well forbid her to go. Eloise was a worthy opponent, and she might prevail in the end, but it would be a long and painful battle. Not to mention that if they did allow her to go, whether after a protracted battle over the subject or not, they would insist upon sending at least 2 of their ranks to accompany her. Eloise shuddered. Those 2 would most probably be her mother and Hyacinth. Good gad, no one could fall in love with those 2 around. No one could even form a mild but lasting attachment, which Eloise thought she might actually be willing to settle for this go-around. She decided that she would make her escape during her sister Daphne's ball. It was to be a grand affair, with hordes of guests, and just the right amount of noise and confusion to allow her absence to go unnoticed for a good 6 hours, maybe more. Her mother had always insisted that they be punctual, early even, when a family member was hosting a social event, so they would surely arrive at Daphne's no later than 8. If she slipped away early on, and the ball did not wind down until the wee hours of the morning, well, it would be nearly dawn before anyone realised she was gone, and she could be halfway to Gloucestershire. And if not halfway, then far enough to ensure that they wouldn't find it too terribly easy to follow her trail. In the end, it had all proven almost frighteningly easy. Her entire family had been distracted by some grand announcement Colin planned to make, and so all she'd had to do was excuse herself to the ladies' retiring room, slip out the back, and walk the short distance to her own home where she'd hidden her bags in the back garden. From there, she needed only to walk to the corner, where she'd arranged to have a hired coach waiting. Goodness, if she'd known it would be this easy to make her own way in the world, she would have done so years ago. And now here she was, rolling toward Gloucestershire. Rolling toward destiny, she supposed, or hoped, she wasn't sure which, with nothing but a few changes of clothing and a pile of letters written to her by a man she'd never met. A man she hoped she could love. It was thrilling. No, it was terrifying. It was, she reflected, quite possibly the most foolhardy thing she'd done in her life, and she had to admit that she'd made a few foolish decisions in her day. Or it might just be her only chance at happiness. Eloise grimaced. She was growing fanciful. That was a bad sign. She needed to approach this adventure with all the practicality and pragmatism with which she always tried to make her decisions. There was still time to turn around. What did she know about this man, really? He'd said quite a lot over the course of a year's correspondence. He was 30 years of age, 2 years her elder. He had attended Cambridge and studied botany. He had been married to her fourth cousin Marina for 8 years, which meant that he'd been 21 at his wedding. He had brown hair. He had all of his teeth. He was a baronet. He lived at Romney Hall, a stone structure built in the 18th century near Tetbury, Gloucestershire. He liked to read scientific treatises and poetry, but not novels, and definitely not works of philosophy. He liked the rain. His favourite colour was green. He had never travelled outside of England. He did not like fish. Eloise fought a bubble of nervous laughter. He didn't like fish. That was what she knew about him.
Surely a sound basis for marriage,
she muttered to herself, trying to ignore the panic in her voice. And what did he know about her? What could have possibly led him to propose marriage to a total stranger? She tried to recall what she had included in her many letters. She was 28. She had brown hair, chestnut really, and all of her teeth. She had grey eyes. She came from a large and loving family. Her brother was a viscount. Her father had died when she was but a child, incomprehensibly brought down by a humble bee sting. She had a tendency to talk too much. Good God, had she really put that into writing? She liked to read poetry and novels, but certainly not scientific treatises or works of philosophy. She had travelled to Scotland, but that was all. Her favourite colour was purple. She did not like mutton and positively detested blood pudding. Another little burst of panicked laughter passed over her lips. Put that way, she thought, with no small bit of sarcasm, she seemed a fine catch indeed. She glanced out the window, as if that might possibly give her an indication as to where they were on the road from London to Tetbury. Rolling green hills looked like rolling green hills looked like rolling green hills, and she could be in Wales for all she knew. Frowning, She looked down at the paper in her lap and refolded Sir Philip's letter. Fitting it back into the ribbon-tied bundle she kept in her valise, she then tapped her fingers against her thighs in a nervous gesture. She had reason to be nervous. She had left home and all that was familiar after all. She was travelling halfway across England, and no one knew. No one. Not even Sir Philip. Because, in her haste to leave London, she'd neglected to tell him she was coming. It wasn't that she'd forgotten. Rather, she'd sort of pushed the task aside until it was too late. If she told him, then she was committed to the plan. This way, she still had the chance to back out at any moment. She told herself it was because she liked to have choices and options. But the truth was, she was quite simply terrified, and she had feared a total loss of her courage. Besides, he was the one who had requested the meeting. He would be happy to see her, wouldn't he? Philip rose from bed and pulled open the draperies in his bedchamber, revealing another perfect sunny day. Perfect. He padded over to his dressing room to find some clothes, having long since dismissed the servants who used to perform these duties. He couldn't explain it, but after Marina had died, he hadn't wanted anyone bustling into his bedroom in the morning, yanking open his curtains and selecting his garments. He'd even dismissed Miles Carter, who had tried so hard to be a friend after Marina's passing. But somehow, the young secretary just made him feel worse, and so he'd sent him on his way, along with 6 months' pay and a superb letter of reference. He'd spent his marriage with Marina looking for someone to talk to, since she was so often absent. But now that she was gone, all he wanted was his own company. He supposed he must have alluded to this in one of his many letters to the mysterious Eloise Bridgerton, because he had sent off his proposal of not quite marriage, but maybe something leading up to it, over a month ago, and the silence on her part had been deafening, especially since she usually responded to his letters with charming alacrity. He frowned. The mysterious Eloise Bridgerton wasn't really so mysterious. In her letters, she seemed quite open and honest and possessed of a positively sunny disposition, which, when it all came down to it, was all he really insisted upon in a wife this time around. He yanked on a work shirt. He planned to spend most of the day in the greenhouse, up to his elbows in dirt. He was rather disappointed that Miss Bridgerton had obviously decided he was some sort of deranged lunatic, to be avoided at all costs. She had seemed the perfect solution to his problems. He desperately needed a mother for Amanda and Oliver, but they'd grown so unmanageable that he couldn't imagine any woman willingly agreeing to cleave unto him in marriage and thus bind herself to those two little devils for life, or at least until they reached majority. Miss Bridgerton was 28, however, quite obviously a spinster, and she'd been corresponding with a complete stranger for over a year. Surely she was a little desperate. Wouldn't she appreciate the chance to find a husband? He had a home, a respectable fortune, and was only 30 years of age. What more could she want? He muttered several annoyed phrases as he thrust his legs into his rough woolen trousers. Obviously she wanted something more, else she would have had the courtesy to at least write back and decline. Thump! Philip glanced up at the ceiling and grimaced. Romney Hall was old and solid and very well built, and if his ceiling was thumping, then his children had dropped, pushed, hurled, something very large indeed. Thump! He winced. That one sounded even worse. Still, their nurse was up there with them, and she always managed them better than he did. If he could just get his boots on in under a minute, he could be out of the house before they inflicted too much more damage, and thus he could pretend none of it was happening. He reached for his boots. Yes, excellent idea. Out of earshot, out of mind. He donned the rest of his ensemble with impressive speed and dashed out into the hall, making quick strides toward the stairs.
"Sir Philip! Sir Philip!"
Damn! His butler was after him now. Philip pretended he didn't hear.
"Sir Philip!"
"Curse it," he muttered. There was no way he could ignore that bellow, unless he was willing to suffer the torture of his servants hovering over him, concerned about his apparent hearing loss.
"Yes,"
he said, turning around slowly.
"Gunning?" "Sir Philip,"
Gunning said, clearing his throat.
"We have a caller."
"A caller?" Philip echoed.
"Was that the source of the, noise?"
Gunning supplied helpfully.
"Yes." "No."
The butler cleared his throat.
"That would have been your children."
"I see," Philip murmured. "How silly of me to have hoped otherwise."
"I don't believe they broke anything, sir."
"That's a relief and a change."
"Indeed, sir. But there is the caller to consider."
Philip groaned. Who on earth was visiting at this time of the morning? It wasn't like they were used to receiving callers, even during reasonable hours. Gunning attempted a smile, but one could see that he was out of practice.
"We used to have callers, do you recall?"
That was the problem with butlers who'd worked for the family since before one was born. They tended to think highly of sarcasm.
"Who is this caller?" "I'm not entirely certain, sir."
"You're not certain?" Philip asked disbelievingly.
"I didn't inquire." "Isn't that what butlers are meant to do?" "Inquire, sir?"
"Yes," Philip ground out, wondering if Gunning was trying to see how red in the face his employer could get without actually collapsing to the floor in an apoplectic fit.
"I thought I'd let you inquire, sir." "You thought you'd let me inquire?"
This one came out as a statement, Philip having realized the futility of asking questions.
"Yes, sir. She's here to see you, after all." "So are all of our callers, and that has never stopped you from ascertaining their identities before." "Well, actually, sir, I'm quite certain,"
Philip tried to interrupt.
"We don't have callers, sir,"
Gunning finished, quite clearly winning the conversational battle. Philip opened his mouth to point out that they did have callers. There was one downstairs that very moment. But really, what was the point?
"Fine," he said, thoroughly irritated. "I'll go downstairs."
Gunning beamed.
"Excellent, sir."
Philip stared at his butler in shock.
"Are you unwell, Gunning?" "No, sir. Why do you ask, sir?"
It didn't seem quite polite to point out that the broad smile made Gunning look a bit like a horse, so Philip just muttered,
"It's nothing,"
and headed down the stairs. A caller? Who would be calling? No one had come to visit in nearly a year, since the neighbours had finished making their obligatory condolence calls. He supposed he couldn't really blame them for staying away. The last time one of them had come to visit, Oliver and Amanda had smeared strawberry jam on the chairs. Lady Winslet had left in a fit of temper quite beyond anything Philip would have thought healthy for a woman of her years. Philip frowned as he reached the bottom of the stairs and turned into the entry hall. It was a she, wasn't it? Hadn't Gunning said his visitor was a she? Who the devil? He stopped short, stumbled even, because the woman standing in his entry hall was young and quite pretty, and when she looked up to meet his gaze, he saw that she had the largest, most achingly beautiful grey eyes he'd ever seen. He could drown in those eyes. And Philip did not, as one might imagine, even think the word drown lightly.
Chapter 2. "And then, I'm sure you will not be surprised to hear, I talked far too much. I simply couldn't stop talking. But I suppose that is what I do when I am nervous. One can only hope I have less cause for nerves as the rest of my life unfolds."
From Eloise Bridgerton to her brother Colin, upon the occasion of Eloise's debut into London society. Then she opened her mouth.
"Sir Philip,"
she asked, and before he even had a chance to nod in the affirmative, she said, at quite the speed of lightning,
"I'm so terribly sorry to arrive unannounced, but I really had no other option, and to be honest, if I'd sent notice, it probably would have arrived behind me, making the notice really quite moot, as I'm sure you'll agree, and..."
Philip blinked. Certain he was supposed to be following what she was saying, but no longer able to make out where one word ended and the next began.
"A long journey, and I'm afraid I didn't sleep, and so I must beg you to forgive my appearance."
She was making him dizzy. Would it be rude if he sat down?
"Didn't bring very much, but I had no choice, and..."
This had clearly gone on far too long, with no sign, in truth, that it would ever end. If he allowed her to speak for one moment longer, he was quite certain that he would suffer an inner ear imbalance. Or perhaps she would swoon from lack of breath and hit her head on the floor. Either way, one of them would be injured and in debilitating pain.
"Madam,"
he said, clearing his throat. If she heard him, she gave no indication. Instead, saying something about the coach that had apparently conveyed her to his doorstep.
"Madam,"
he said, a little louder this time.
"But then I..."
She looked up, blinking those devastating grey eyes at him, and for a moment he felt frighteningly off balance.
"Yes?"
she asked. Now that he had her attention, he seemed to have forgotten why he'd sought it.
He asked.
"Who are you?" She stared at him for a good 5 seconds, her lips parting with surprise, and then she finally answered,
"Eloise Bridgerton, of course."
Eloise was fairly certain she was talking too much, and she knew she was talking too fast, but she tended to do that when she was nervous, and while she prided herself on the fact that she was rarely nervous, now seemed like a rather deserving time to explore that emotion. And besides, Sir Philip, if indeed he was the large bear of a man standing before her, was not at all what she had expected.
"You're Eloise Bridgerton?"
She looked up into his gaping face and felt the first stirrings of annoyance.
"Well, of course I am. Who else would I be?"
"I could not possibly imagine."
"You did invite me,"
she pointed out.
"And you did not respond to my invitation,"
he returned. She swallowed. He had a point there. A rather large one, if one wanted to be fair, which she didn't. Not just then, anyway.
"I didn't really have the opportunity,"
she hedged. And then, when it seemed from his expression that that wasn't enough explanation, she added,
"As I mentioned when I spoke earlier."
He stared at her for longer than made her comfortable, his dark eyes inscrutable, and then he said,
"I didn't understand a word you said."
She felt her mouth form an oval of surprise? No, annoyance.
"Weren't you listening?"
she asked.
"I tried."
Eloise pursed her lips.
"Very well, then,"
she said, counting to 5 in her head, in Latin, before adding,
"My apologies. I am sorry to have arrived unannounced. It was dreadfully ill-bred of me."
He was silent for a full 3 seconds. Eloise counted that as well, before saying,
"I accept your apology."
She cleared her throat.
"And of course,"
he coughed, glancing around as if in search of someone who might save him from her,
"I am delighted that you are here."
It would probably be impolite to point out that he sounded anything but delighted, so Eloise just stood there, staring at his right cheekbone as she tried to decide what she could say without insulting him. Eloise considered it a sad state of affairs that she, who generally had something to say for any occasion, couldn't think of a thing. Luckily, he saved their awkward silence from growing to monumental proportions by asking,
"Is this all of your luggage?"
Eloise straightened her shoulders, delighted to move on to a comparatively trivial topic.
Yes, I didn't really...
She broke herself off. Did she really need to tell him that she'd stolen away from home in the middle of the night? It didn't seem to speak well of her, or of her family, for that matter. She wasn't sure why, but she didn't want him to know that she had, for all intents and purposes, run away. She wasn't certain why she thought so, but she had a distinct feeling that if he knew the truth, he'd pack her up and send her back to London post-haste. And while her meeting with Sir Philip had not thus far proven to be the stuff of romance and bliss she'd imagined it to be, she was not yet prepared to give up, especially when that meant running back to her family with her tail between her legs.
"This is all I have," she said firmly.
"Good. He looked around again, this time a little desperately, which Eloise did not find flattering in the least.
"Gunning!"
he bellowed. The butler appeared so quickly that he must have been eavesdropping.
"Yes, sir?"
"We, need to prepare a room for Miss Bridgerton."
"I have already done so,"
Gunning assured him. Sir Philip's cheeks coloured slightly.
"Good," he grunted. "She will be staying here for..."
He looked to her in askance.
"A fortnight,"
she supplied, hoping that was about the right amount of time.
"A fortnight,"
Sir Philip reiterated, as if the butler wouldn't have heard her reply.
"We will do everything in our power to make her comfortable, of course."
"Of course,"
the butler agreed.
"Good,"
Sir Philip said, still looking somewhat uncomfortable with the entire situation. Or, if not uncomfortable precisely, then perhaps weary, which might have been even worse. Eloise was disappointed. She'd pictured him as a man of easy charm, rather like her brother Colin, who possessed a dashing smile and always knew what to say in any situation, awkward or otherwise. Sir Philip, on the other hand, looked as if he'd rather be anywhere else but where he was, which Eloise did not find encouraging, as his present surroundings included her. And what's more, he was supposed to be making at least some effort to make her acquaintance and determine if she would make him an acceptable wife. And his efforts had better be good ones indeed, because if it was true that first impressions were the most accurate, she rather doubted that she would determine that he would make an acceptable husband. She smiled at him through gritted teeth.
"Would you like to sit down?"
he blurted out.
"That would be quite pleasing, thank you."
He looked around with a blank expression on his face, giving Eloise the impression he barely knew his way around his own house.
"Here,"
he mumbled, motioning to a door at the end of the hall.
"The drawing room."
Gunning coughed. Sir Philip looked at him and scowled.
"Perhaps you intended to order refreshments, sir?"
the butler asked solicitously.
Yes, of course,"
Sir Philip replied, clearing his throat.
"Of course. Perhaps a tea tray, perhaps?"
Gunning suggested.
"With muffins?"
"Excellent," Sir Philip muttered.
"Or perhaps, if Miss Bridgerton is hungry,"
the butler continued,
"I could have a more extensive breakfast prepared."
Sir Philip swung his gaze over to Eloise.
"Muffins will be lovely,"
she said, even though she was hungry. Eloise allowed Sir Philip to take her arm and lead her to the drawing room, where she sat on a sofa covered in striped blue satin. The room was neat and clean, but the furnishings were shabby. The entire house had a vague, neglected quality to it, as if the owner had run out of money, or perhaps just didn't care. Eloise tended to think that it was the latter. She supposed it was possible that Sir Philip was short of funds, but the grounds had been magnificent, and she had seen enough of his greenhouse as she was driving in to realise that it was in excellent condition. Given that Sir Philip was a botanist, that might explain the great care given to the exterior, while the interior was left to fade. Clearly, he needed a wife. She folded her hands in her lap, then watched as he took a seat across from her, folding his large frame into a chair that had obviously been designed for one much smaller than he. He looked most uncomfortable, and Eloise had enough brothers to recognise the signs, rather like he wanted desperately to curse. But Eloise decided it was his own fault for choosing that chair, and so she smiled at him in what she hoped was a polite and encouraging manner, waiting for him to begin the conversation. He cleared his throat. She leaned forward. He cleared his throat again. She coughed. He cleared his throat once more. "Do you need some tea?" she finally asked, unable to bear even the thought of one more ahem. He looked up gratefully, although Eloise wasn't certain whether that was due to her offer of tea or her merciful breaking of the silence. "Yes," he said. "That would be lovely." Eloise opened her mouth to reply, then remembered she was in his house and had no business offering tea, not to mention that he ought to have remembered that fact as well.
"Right," she said. "Well, I'm sure it will be here soon."
"Right," he agreed, shifting in his seat.
"I'm sorry to have come by unannounced," she murmured,
even though she'd already said as much. But something had to be said. Sir Philip might be well used to awkward pauses, but Eloise was the sort who liked to fill any silence.
"It's quite all right," he said.
"It's not, actually," she replied. "It was terribly ill-mannered of me to do so, and I apologise."
He looked startled at her frankness.
"Thank you," he murmured. "It is no problem, I assure you. I was merely..."
"Surprised?" she offered.
"Yes," she nodded.
"Yes. Well, anyone would have been. I should have thought of that. And I truly am sorry for the inconvenience."
He opened his mouth, but then closed it, instead glancing out the window.
"It's a sunny day," he said.
"Yes, it is,"
Eloise agreed, thinking that quite obvious. He shrugged.
"I imagine it will still rain by nightfall."
She wasn't quite certain how to respond to that, so she just nodded, surreptitiously studying him while his gaze was still fixed on the window. He was bigger than she'd imagined him, rougher looking, less urbane. His letters had been so charming and well written. She'd pictured him to be more smooth, more slender, perhaps, certainly not given to fat, but still less muscled. He looked as if he worked outside like a labourer, especially in those rough trousers and shirt with no cravat. And even though he'd written that his hair was brown, she'd always imagined him as a dark blonde, looking rather like a poet. Why she always pictured poets with blonde hair, she did not know. But his hair was exactly as he'd described it. Brown, a rather dark shade, actually, bordering on black, with an unruly wave to it. His eyes were brown, much the same shade as his hair, so dark they were utterly unreadable. She frowned. She hated people she couldn't figure out in a heartbeat.
"Did you travel all night?" he inquired politely.
"I did."
"You must be tired,"
she nodded.
"I am, quite."
He stood, motioning gallantly to the door.
"Would you prefer to rest? I don't wish to keep you here if you'd rather sleep."
Eloise was exhausted, but she was also ferociously hungry.
"I'll have just a bite to eat first," she said, "and then I would be grateful to accept your hospitality and rest."
He nodded and started to sit down, trying to fold himself back into the ridiculously small chair, then finally muttering something under his breath, turning to her with a slightly more intelligible,
"Excuse me,"
and moving to another, larger chair.
"I beg your pardon,"
he said once he was settled. Eloise just nodded at him, wondering when she had ever found herself in a more awkward situation. He cleared his throat.
"Was your journey a pleasant one?"
"Indeed,"
she replied, mentally giving him credit for at least trying to keep up a conversation. One good turn deserved another, so she made her contribution with,
"You have a lovely home."
He raised a brow at that, giving her a look that said he didn't believe her false flattery for a second.
"The grounds are magnificent,"
she added hastily. Who would have thought that he'd actually know his furnishings were faded? Men never noticed such things.
"Thank you," he said. "I am a botanist, as you know, and so I spend a great deal of my time out of doors."
"Were you planning to work outside today?"
He answered in the affirmative. Eloise offered him a tentative smile.
"I'm sorry to have disrupted your schedule."
"It is nothing, I assure you.
But
you really needn't apologize again," he cut in, "for anything."
And then there was that awful silence again, with both of them looking longingly at the door, waiting for Gunning to return with salvation in the form of a tea tray. Eloise tapped her hands against the cushion of the sofa in a manner that her mother would have deemed horribly ill-bred. She looked over at Sir Philip, and was somewhat gratified to see that he was doing the same. Then he caught her looking, and quirked an irritating half-smile as his gaze dropped down to her restless hand. She stilled herself immediately. She looked over at him, silently daring, imploring him to say something, anything. He didn't. This was killing her. She had to break the silence. This was not natural. It was too awful. People were meant to talk. This was... She opened her mouth, driven by a desperation she didn't quite understand. But before she could continue on with the sentence she fully intended to make up as she went along, a blood-curdling scream ripped through the air. Eloise jumped to her feet.
"What was..." "My children,"
Sir Philip said, letting out a haggard sigh.
"You have children?"
He noticed that she was standing, and rose wearily to his feet. "Of course." She gaped at him.
"You never said you had children."
His eyes narrowed.
"Is that a problem?"
he asked quite sharply.
"Of course it isn't,"
she said, bristling.
"I adore children. I have more nieces and nephews than I can count, and I can assure you that I am their favourite aunt. But that does not excuse the fact that you did not mention their existence."
"That is impossible," he said, shaking his head. "You must have overlooked it."
Her chin jerked back so suddenly it was a wonder she didn't snap her neck.
"That is not," she said haughtily, "the sort of thing I would overlook."
He shrugged, clearly dismissing her protest.
"You never mentioned them," she said, "and I can prove it."
He crossed his arms, giving her a patently disbelieving look. She marched to the door.
"Where is my valise?"
"Right where you left it, I imagine,"
he said, watching her with a condescending expression.
"Or more likely already up in your room. My servants are not that inattentive."
She turned to him with a scowl.
"I have every single one of your letters with me, and I can assure you, not one of them contains the words, 'my children.'"
Philip's lips parted in surprise.
"You saved my letters?"
"Of course. Didn't you save mine?"
He blinked.
She gasped.
"You didn't save them?"
Philip had never understood women, and half the time was quite willing to put aside all current medical thought and declare them a separate species altogether. He fully accepted that he rarely knew what one was supposed to say to them, but this time even he knew he had blundered badly.
"I'm sure I have some of them,"
he tried. Her jaw clamped into a straight, angry line.
"Most of them, I'm sure,"
he added hastily. She looked mutinous. Eloise Bridgerton, he was coming to realise, had a formidable will.
"It's not that I would have disposed of them,"
he said, trying to dig his way out of his bottomless pit.
"It is just that I'm not certain precisely where I put them."
He watched with interest as she gained control of her anger. then let out a short breath. Her eyes, however, remained a stormy grey.
"Very well," she said. "It hardly signifies anyway."
Exactly his opinion, Philip thought, but even he was smart enough not to say so. Besides, her tone made it quite clear that in her opinion it did signify a great deal. Another scream rent the air, followed by a resounding crash. Philip winced. It sounded like furniture. Eloise glanced toward the ceiling, as if expecting plaster to start spinning down at any moment.
"Shouldn't you go to them?" she asked.
He should, but by all that was holy, he didn't want to. When the twins were out of control, no one could manage them, which, Philip supposed, was the definition of out of control. It was his opinion that it was generally easier to let them run wild until they dropped from exhaustion, which usually didn't take too long, and deal with them then. It probably wasn't the most beneficial course of action, and certainly nothing that any other parent would have recommended, but a man only had so much energy to deal with 2 8-year-olds, and he feared he'd run out of his a good 6 months ago.
"Sir Philip,"
Eloise prodded. He let out a breath.
"You're right, of course.
It certainly wouldn't do to appear a disinterested parent in front of Miss Bridgerton, whom he was trying to woo, however clumsily, into the position of mother to the 2 hellions presently attempting the complete destruction of his home.
If you will excuse me,"
he said, giving her a nod as he stepped into the hall.
"Oliver!"
he bellowed.
"Amanda!"
He wasn't sure, but he thought he heard Miss Bridgerton stifle a horrified laugh. A wave of irritation washed over him, and he glared at her, even though he knew he shouldn't. He supposed she thought she could do a better job with those 2 hellions. He strode to the stairs and yelled the twins' names again. On the other hand, maybe he shouldn't be so uncharitable. He rather hoped. No, fervently prayed that Eloise Bridgerton could do a better job with the twins than he could. Good God, if she could teach them to mind, he would bloody well kiss the ground she walked upon on a thrice-daily schedule. Oliver and Amanda rounded the corner in the staircase and descended the rest of the way down to the hall, looking not a bit sheepish.
"What," Philip demanded, "was that all about?"
"What was what all about?"
Oliver replied cheekily.
"The screaming," Philip ground out.
"That was Amanda,"
Oliver said.
"It certainly was," she agreed.
Philip waited for further elucidation, and when it appeared that none was forthcoming, he added,
"And why was Amanda screaming?"
"It was a frog," she explained.
"A frog?"
She nodded.
"Indeed, in my bed."
"I see," Philip said. "Do you have any idea how it got there?"
"I put it there,"
she replied. He swung his gaze off of Oliver, to whom he'd addressed his question, and back to Amanda.
"You put a frog in your own bed?"
She nodded. Why? He cleared his throat.
"Why?"
She shrugged.
"I wanted to."
Philip felt his chin thrust forward in disbelief.
"You wanted to?"
"Yes."
"Put a frog in your bed?"
"I was trying to grow tadpoles," she explained.
"In your bed?"
"It seemed warm and cosy."
"I helped,"
Oliver put in.
"Of that I had no doubt,"
Philip said in a tight voice.
"But why did you scream?"
"I didn't scream,"
Oliver said indignantly.
"Amanda did."
"I was asking Amanda,"
Philip said, just barely resisting the urge to throw his arms up in defeat and retire to his greenhouse.
"You were looking at me, sir,"
Oliver said, and then, as if his father were too dim to understand what he meant, he added,
"When you asked the question."
Philip took a deep breath before schooling his features into what he hoped was a patient expression, and turned back to Amanda.
"Why?"
Amanda, did you scream? She shrugged.
I forgot I put the frog there.
I thought she was going to die,
Oliver put in most dramatically. Philip decided not to pursue that statement.
I thought, he said, crossing his arms and levelling his sternest gaze at his children,